Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, marhaba, ciao, bonjour, namaste, jumbo. Bienvenidos. Hey, my name is Jed Lee. Welcome to Reading with Your Kids. We are broadcasting from the vibrant and book-loving neighborhood of Reedville, the loveliest neighborhood in all of Boston, Massachusetts. Reading with Your Kids is more than just a podcast. It's a movement. Our mission is to help families grow stronger, closer, and kinder through the magic of reading together. And we're absolutely thrilled to have you with us on that journey. Please help us spread the joy by sharing this podcast with the people you love. Tell your kids, teachers, school librarians, and neighbors that they can hear us on the WREB AM-FM 24/7 radio network. And they can find us on the iHeartRadio app, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Good Pods, Podcast Addict. Wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading with Your Kids. Absolutely fantastic episode for you today. First up, John Eric Lapano is here to celebrate the language of birds. Later in the show, Dr. Usma Farouk will be here to celebrate The Boy Who Cried Wolf and other great stories. And Heather Fontaine Youngs is back on the show to celebrate mine. Join us right now from the very beautiful but snowy province of Ontario in Canada. Our guest is here today to celebrate his brand new beautiful picture book, The Language of Birds. Please welcome to the show, John Eric Lapano. John Eric, how are you?
I'm doing really well, Jed. Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here despite the frosty weather outside.
Yes. Let's see if we can warm things up. Certainly, I mean, The Language of Birds, it's a heartwarming book.
Truly, yes. Yeah, I think this book is really near and dear to my heart, and it comes very much from that place of like wanting human connection and seeking it out in different ways and all the different ways that can come about. So, yeah.
Yeah, and now in this book, I understand the main character is a young girl who can talk to birds, but not so much people.
That's right. Yes, Mira is a beautiful young child who, ever since she was little, had a very profound connection with birds. So she's been, you know, marveling at them from a young age. She used to coo to the doves, and she feels like she connects with them and knows their language. But people are sort of a different sort of animal to Mira. They're more confusing. You know, their words might say one thing and their faces or their actions say another. And so she's, you know, grown to be quite a solitary child. She spends most of her recesses under a maple tree, feeding seeds to a crow, and she's perfectly content with that. But then all that changes when a new boy comes to school from over the ocean. And she decides she wants to connect with this boy because she feels that he sees trees in the way that she sees birds.
Yeah. I think all of us, if we can't remember having somebody like this in our lives in school, we certainly, I think if we're parents, we maybe can look at the kids in our kids' classrooms. I know that mm-hmm. there was a young girl in my daughter's class, and my daughter was part of the most beautiful group of kids ever. I mean, they were just sweet. Mm-hmm. They were supportive. They went to a Catholic school, so I was very involved. But there was one little girl in class who was just quiet, and it didn't matter how many times or how kids would invite her mm-hmm. to include her. She was always just, no, I'm cool over here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really where it came from. I mean, for me is just observing, you know, my own children. I have three beautiful, beautiful daughters, and they're each so unique and individual. And, you know, some are a little more quiet than others. And just observing that, knowing what's inside them is not always outwardly present. And, you know, certainly a lot of the inspiration for this book came from them in their early childhood and just watching, like, you know, when our kids are really little, there's this different kind of language that they kind of speak, which is a bit more communal with the world around them, right? A little more in touch and in tune with nature and the natural world. And then as kids grow up, they certainly, you know, lean a bit further into developing those skills that allow them to communicate with people. And you might lose a bit of that sort of inherent, that intrinsic language, that communion with the natural world. But not all kids really lean into that so hard. They might stay inside. They might stay internal. And I just wanted to write a story for them. Certainly traveling, with my books and reading in classrooms, you do see all different types of kids, all different types of learners, different types of minds, different ways of connecting. And it's really important, I think, to me that those quieter kids are reflected in stories, that they see themselves in stories, that they don't feel, you know, bad about the fact that they may not always have the right words, and that doesn't mean they can't connect and that they can't find deep connection.
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, those kids who have that one, you know, that really strong connection with one or two kids, their connection is much deeper and much more real than the man about campus, the guy who everybody knows and everybody is friends with.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Fully agree. And that's this friendship between, in the story, the friendship between Mira and Jad, who comes from over the ocean. It's very nonverbal, right? You know, perhaps Jad doesn't speak the language. It's not really established, but that's sort of in my mind. And so they connect through art. You know, they find meaning and connection to bond over something that's, this sort of deeper human language. And I think it's, you know, we find our people. Sometimes that takes longer. Sometimes that's, we're lucky to find those people right away. I just want kids to trust that they'll find their people.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the idea that this book will encourage kids to develop friendships that are kind of unconventional. It's like, we don't have to gossip about what's on Instagram or the latest cartoon. We can just kind of chill and be next to each other doing art. And that's a connection.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we live in a world now for sure. I mean, I'm a parent, like I said, and it's a strange time to navigate. You know, there is a bit of a tendency, I think, with screens and social media and all of that to make the human experience a bit more uniform. You know, we try to share the same memes, share the same, you know, cultural moments. But, you know, what's beautiful about early childhood is the imagination is completely just, you're immersed in that world. And the more sort of diversity of thought we have, and the more we embrace the different diversities of thought, the more rich those imaginative worlds can be. And kids, I think, need to occupy that space more. You know, all the way up to adolescence, I think we're letting go of that really unique space a little too early, in service of, you know, these mediated tech spaces. And just like, there's so much that can be alive in just watching the birds, and just paying close attention to the world around you. And we can get really, really, you know, rich experiences out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. In addition to, you know, social media taking over kids and technology taking over kids' attention, one of the things that I was finding, and this I started noticing this decades ago, was the need that a lot of very well-intentioned educators and adults have to schedule everything in kids' lives. I ran an after-school program. And I remember getting all sorts of grief because I came up with this outrageous idea of when the kids arrived at the after-school program, we give them 20 minutes to do whatever they want. They've been in class all day long. They've been sitting in desk, and hey, you just want to run around for 20 minutes? Go for it. You want to sit underneath the tree? Go for it. It's your time. And boy, I got an awful lot of grief from the kids. Loved it, but the quote-unquote educators, the people, the experts thought I was just – out of my tree.
You know, that's so, yeah, I fully agree. Like, that downtime as a parent, it's something we've really tried to encourage my wife and I and our children. Like, go outside and be bored for like 2 hours. You're going to come up with something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our kids would call us strict with screen time. They often do. Mm-hmm. But I think they have these extremely well-honed imaginations, our children. And, it can be tricky to control that, right? Like as an educator, it's tough to say go wild and embrace the chaos. But I do think we got to give kids more trust to know what to do. Like it's in us. We've been doing it for millennia, right? Like what do you do with 8 hours of daylight? You'll find something, you know.
Yeah. Are you actually getting 8 hours of daylight now in Ontario? I don't think.
Barely. Not quite. No. We're about to hit the shortest day of the year. So that was wishful thinking on my part for sure.
You were mentioning, and I don't mean to kind of go down this rabbit hole, but you're talking about, you know, maybe kids have this, especially young kids have this connection and ability to communicate with nature that we kind of grow out of or lose. And I've been listening to weird podcasts myself. I've heard some people think that maybe at some point we communicate before we had formal language, we communicated more, with telepathy. Boy, I'm having a hard time with English today. because I was thinking you could hear my thoughts.
I intuited it. I picked it up. Yeah.
But I'm wondering if that's, you know, something that may be some merit to that. We have this innate skill that we kind of mutated out of and that we're not using anymore. But maybe there are some kids that are using it at a young age, and maybe some kids on the spectrum who aren't communicating in traditional ways are actually able to do.
I fully believe that. And in fact, it's been a bit of a theme that's run through many of my books is this, especially in childhood, this deep connection with nature. It's a sense of belonging. I remember being really young and just being content to sit under a couple of white pine trees in my backyard. And just the feeling there was a feeling of safety. It was a feeling of like belonging, like I said. I do think we think a little too narrow about communication. It happens in all sorts of ways. There's an infinite number of languages, I think, out there that we're picking up on different levels that we may not be completely tuned into. But I did see it with my children. Like, there's one story, which is many of these little vignettes in the book happened to me and my kids. And one of our daughters could only nap. She was brutal napper, like did not nap as an infant. But if you put her under a tree, you know, even or outside in the winter, fully bundled up, it just like being outside with the bird song, the leaves rustling in the wind would immediately lull her to sleep. It's, I think there's really something very profound about, you know, our environments and our places within them. When I think of, you know, kids loving magic, for example, magic and, you know, fairies and wonder, like that's been a consistent theme in all my kids. Like their eyes light up because I think when you're young, the world is magic. Mm. Like it is wild to watch what happens in our natural world that we just take for granted. But if you're seeing it with new eyes, it's like that tree is like, you know, 100 feet tall. And it's fully bending in the wind right now. This windstorm is like, there's something alive in this. And I think, I do think that people of different, like, you know, whether different levels on the spectrum can sort of tune into different frequencies of communication. Mm-hmm. And we as a society, I think, need to be open to that. I think that's happening more and more. We're getting a lot better at, you know, accepting all different types of people for, and all their different ways of communicating. And so, I really don't want us to lose that. I think it's so powerful. And, you know, the digital world is very enticing and alluring, but like it doesn't hold a candle to what you have available to you right outside. You know, whether it's a cityscape, whether it's a, you know, a rural setting, whether it's like deep in the forest, like our environments are just vibrating with magic. So,
yeah. I, you know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking back, and you know, being in a rock band in high school and just having that communication, knowing where you're going, you just and trusting in each other. Same thing on the soccer field. Same thing. I know there've been a couple of recently toured El Salvador with a group called Clowns Without Borders, and
cool.
And one of the other performers just had this kind of rhythm. We didn't even speak the same language, but we had this rhythm. And another member of the troupe was like, "How do you guys know? How do you?" And I'm like, "Don't ask me to explain it. I don't want to know. I just, you know, if I, yeah. if I know, I might lose it."
I love that. It's the flow, right? It's
right.
Like, I used to play music as well as a younger person. And when you hit that zone, it's like everything clicks, and it's transient, right? Like mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. maybe for the first 10 minutes, it's not quite there. And then all of a sudden you fall into this groove, and then it kind of, you fall out of it. But mm-hmm. those, like it to me, it's the same with writing. It's the same with anything creative. There are energies out there, right? And sometimes you hit the same wavelength and good things happen.
Yeah. And again, this is going to be a weird question, so just say it's too weird for me to answer. But I know that, you know, there's this firewall that's put up between an author and an illustrator when they're creating a picture book together, and you don't typically have any communication except through the art director. I'm wondering, do you think maybe that there's some kind of unspoken communication that happens between with the manuscript, you know, and somehow there's a connection, maybe, because I've heard so many times authors come on and say, "Wow, when I, like you said, when I saw those images, when I saw the art, it was exactly what I had in mind." And how does that happen if you don't have any communication?
That's a great question. It's not a weird question. I love that question. So I do think, you know, there's something about, when you're writing a manuscript, I try really hard to leave space. You know, it's that space in what the words aren't saying. That's where the magic happens to me, where it's like the illustrator is thinking in pictures and images. I really do have an image in mind when I'm writing. It's not always exactly what I'm picturing that the illustrator will come back with, but it's always better. You know what I mean? Like, in my experience, I've been really lucky that the illustrators I've worked with come back with just the choices that they make around, this is where the camera is going to be, you know, in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's an interplay between words and images and picture books. That's is why I love the genre. Is it very much is a giving up on both parties. Like, here are my words. I give them to you to inspire something in you. And if that inspiration is helping you express yourself artistically and you're feeling good about that, I'm going to feel good about that. You know? So I think I do think there's something in the, in that interplay. And I don't know, I can't quite pinpoint what it is, but certainly it happens in the spaces for me, the spaces between. And, you know, there is I think there, it must be nerve wracking to be an illustrator to mm-hmm. say, like, did I nail this? Like, mm-hmm. But I think if the words are moving you as an artist, however they move you is, if you're true to that expression, it's going to be good.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I fully answered it, but maybe there's something mystical to it. Maybe it's just someone's in their zone, you know?
Well, you know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking back. My daughter right now is a very successful young woman. But we spent a lot of quiet time together, whether it was looking at books. When she was in high school, she used to come out on tour with me for 3 weeks at a time, and we were traveling around the U.S. and we would go for hours driving in the car, just not speaking, not needing to speak. And I'm thinking The Language of Birds is one of those books that we would have experienced again and again. And a lot of times it would have been a quiet experience where we're just kind of looking at a spread and maybe talking about it and looking, what are you seeing now? And you know, picking up on the story and do you know anybody like this in your class kind of thing?
I love that. The quiet moments. Right now I'm in a point in my parenting where we have three rambunctious, vivacious kids. The quiet moments are few and far between. The bedtime routines, you know, I just cherish those so much. Laying down together with a picture book or a chapter book and just the reading, or like you say, the looking and the exploring images. It's why it means so much to me when I hear from parents or kids or, you know, like, we love your book. We read it over and over. It's like, what makes a book a favorite book, I think, is a recipe no one can pinpoint. You know, I have books that are so memorable from my childhood that sometimes I'll bring them up and people are like, I never heard of that book, you know, but it was something about the pictures or the tone or the vibe that the book gave me that I just cherished it so much. And I hope that if my books can do that for anyone, or any, you know, help foster those quiet moments between parents and children, or just with children by themselves on the couch, like, that's great. That's everything.
Yeah. I'm curious about your creative process. Is it, do you start off with the what if question, or does an idea pop into your head and you're just able to sit down and write out the story in one setting, and then you go back and, you know, work at it with, you know, in the editing process? What's it like when John Eric gets a story idea?
Oh, it's a great question. I think it happens differently every time. I do have a day job, which takes up a lot of my time. And so I get a lot of my writing done in the off hours. So late at night, weekends, if I'm lucky to get away for, you know, a weekend, a year kind of thing. And those moments are usually not super productive. I find what happens to me is I'll have an idea kind of swirling around in my head for weeks. Sometimes a phrase will come to me. Sometimes it's an idea or a question, like you said, but something that's knocking around for a while. And eventually I'll get itchy enough to, sit down and try to write something of it. My drafts usually come out in one burst. So I'll get the full story out. And then I'll tinker, for, you know, sometimes a couple weeks, sometimes longer, until I feel it's at a point where I have the confidence to share it, you know, with an agent or an editor. And, you know, usually I'll share with my kids first. They're the first round editors, and I can tell immediately when I got something that's a dud, you know, they're just, the eyes glaze over, they turn away. It's like, you're not listening. It's okay. It's not there. But yeah, I have been, with picture books, they're almost fully formed in my head because they've been knocking around for so long that when I sit down, it's just an exercise and like, I'm inspired. I have the time and space right now to do this. It'll come out in one burst, and then the tinkering can take longer. The finessing. Yeah.
Do you have something that you're tinkering with right now?
I have a few things right now. I have one that I've tinkered with enough that we'll be pitching it in the new year. And that story is I'm hopeful for that one. And then I have a middle grade novel that I've been tinkering with for years. And that's a whole other experience. Writing long form, is very different. You know, I've typically as a writer been like a short story writer or a picture book writer. So it's like, I can see the full thing and I can get it out. Whereas with the novel, it's been such a frustrating and gratifying process. You know, it's, you go through every, you know, the cycle of confidence to self-doubt, back up to confidence. It's like a roller coaster, and it's really helping me hone my craft, but also just teach myself that, you know, I don't write for an outcome so much as I write to get whatever's in me out. You know, it's writing for writing's sake, I think, has been when I've been most successful. When I think too deeply about the outcome, it's blocked in some way. And so maybe that speaks, you know, to the flow we were talking about earlier, is if you can be honest to the feeling inside you and realizing that this writing is just an expression of that feeling. I've chosen writing for this, but maybe it's not working as a story. Maybe this is like a poem, or maybe this is me noodling on the guitar for a little bit for no one to ever hear, or maybe this is a painting. And I think I've been lucky to have found writing as a really great outlet. But it's more the practice of sitting down writing just to get stuff out there. Yeah.
That's fantastic. We should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about the language of birds and find out more about you.
Well, they can go to jelapano.com/books to learn about me and all the different books I've written, including this one. They can also go to Penguin Random House and search for the language of birds. Wherever they like to buy books is what I say. It's available in Canada and the U.S. right now. Strong plug to support local independent bookstores. I was just saying today that they are vital to especially local authors, emerging authors. Without our local independent bookstores, like, we wouldn't have the momentum, the encouragement, the enthusiasm behind us. You know, my local bookstore here in Stratford does so much for me. And they bring literature into our communities, you know. So they're struggling right now, a lot of them, but it's just my favorite places in the world are bookstores. They're well curated places. If you can go and check it out at your local store, it'll be out December 16th, which I don't know when the podcast will be out, but it's 5 days away. So, yeah, it should be available wherever you buy books.
We have had an excellent time speaking to the author of The Language of Birds. It's a brand new picture book from our guest, John Eric Lapano. Hey, John Eric, thanks so much for being on Reading With Your Kids.
Thank you so much, Jed. It was a real pleasure.
Hey, before you invite Dr. Usma back into the studio, we want to let you know that we have some great things cooking for 2026. Be sure to stay tuned to find out all that is happening in the Reading With Your Kids Network in 2026. Join us right now from beautiful Miami and the state of Florida. Our guest is here today to celebrate her picture book. It's called The Boy Who Cried Wolf and Other Great Stories with Lessons. Please welcome to the show Dr. Usma Farooq. Dr. Usma, how are you?
I'm great, Jed. Thanks for having me on your show.
Delighted to have you on. Tell the Boy Who Cried Wolf, that's a classic tale. Is your book filled with classic stories retold?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. So I started it over 14 years ago, and I've been working on it on and off. You know, there were periods of not working on it, but it's an old idea of mine. And I read through several versions of Aesop's Fables because that was my favorite when I was little. I have a beautiful illustrated copy that my dad gave me when I was like 10 years old. And I still have it. I'm 47 now. And I said, you know what? I want to make an updated, fresh collection for today's space with new illustrations, kind of a redo on something everybody knows. It's nostalgic. You know, you've heard the morals, like, don't count your chickens before they hatch and slow and steady wins the race. We all know these. And they're always passed down regardless of country, culture, race. Everybody knows these stories. Aesop's fables have a lore and they're 2,000 years old. But I wanted to redo it. And so my book is a collection of 13 of my favorite. And there's other ones I like too, but I pick 13. And me and my sons rewrote the fables in our own words, right? Because you can retell things in your own words.
Yeah.
And we found a fantastic illustrator. And so we have an illustration for each story, and, it's done very well. People really like it. The kids are drawn to it. I've read the book at multiple bookstores and at schools. And the kids know these stories, but they want to hear them again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that was the project.
Yeah. Well, let's give a shout out to your illustrator.
Yeah. Wing.
Excellent.
Yes, Wing in London.
Awesome. And now, how is your retelling different than what we might have heard before?
So there, I kept the classic vibe, if you will. It's not like a new twist. There's no plot twists. I didn't change the endings. But, you know, and with all due respect to the old versions, they're a little bit dated. For example, you know, they use a lot of animals, right? And my stories all have animals too. But the donkey in all the other prior versions is called an ass. You know, so if the language is a little bit dated, so I made it a little fresh and lively. And it's actually, elevated vocabulary. So it's not, the cat sat on the mat. It's not at the kinder pre-K level. It's a little bit higher than that. And I did that on purpose so the kids can learn a few words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's still a classic feeling. But it's a little bit more, it's like a fresh coat of paint.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I love to remind authors about, and this was something that I was very pleasantly surprised to learn, is that picture books are meant to be read by an adult to a kid or with a kid. And so having that elevated language is perfectly appropriate for a picture book because you have an adult right there to help you understand it.
Sure. And I actually think that adults will like this book as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is it about Aesop's fables that we're still talking about them 2,000 years later?
Because there are some extremely valuable lessons. Excuse me, Jed, one second. There are some extremely valuable, life-changing lessons that are built into these stories. And actually, these stories are not sugar-coated. So I have a bunch of reviews for my book, and they're all good reviews, thankfully. But some of the, let's say there's mostly 5 stars, but some are 4 because the reviewer says that they're a little bit dark. They're a little bit edgy. There's, you know, some of the characters don't survive because they didn't prepare for the harsh winter coming ahead. So there is a kind of pinch to the story sometimes, and that teaches the lesson. It's mm-hmm. built into the reality check, if mm-hmm. you will. So I think there's a universality to the stories because there's something to learn. There's a dark turn if you don't learn it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that intrigues people, I think.
Yep, yep. One of the things... I remember the first time I read the original versions of Grimm's Fairy Tale. And I'm
right.
like, and this is really grim.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you're sitting down with your kids and you're reading these stories and there's a dark twist, just like the big words, you have a grown up there to help you understand why that
sure.
might happen. And I think, you know, to hide these realities from kids, I don't think does them any service at all.
I guess not. And that's why, you know, like, for example, in The Ants and the Grasshopper, which is one of the stories in the book, the ants are working hard, as ants do, right? Mm-hmm. They're creatures of labor, beasts of burden, right? So they're prepping, they're storing, they're gathering the food for the winter. They're chugging along, and the grasshopper is clowning around and playing his violin and not preparing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, when you'll read the story and see, the grasshopper doesn't make it. And when I had the option of just saying he starved, and I also had the option of saying he starved to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had originally written to death. And then of course the editor was like, it's a little bit tough, you know, like the kids might not like the to death part, but I kept it in there because you don't forget, and this is how I learned Aesop, and I remember Aesop, is the toughness in the lesson is how you learn the lesson. You mm-hmm. may not remember any of these stories of everything sugar-coated.
Right, Right.
They may not have the value.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I agree. One of the things that we've explored here on the podcast is the books that how books that are written for the U.S. market differ from books that are written for example, the Latin American market or maybe European markets or other markets around the world. And the thing that I've heard repeatedly is that books that are written for other markets outside the U.S. tend to be a little bit darker. And I think that's totally appropriate.
Well, we translated the entire book into Spanish, so maybe it'll do well in the. I hope it does well in the Latin market. I'm working on that still. The Spanish translation is finished. I'm really proud of it because I'm not a native Spanish speaker, and I still went out of my way to do it because I feel like it has a big value in a language that's very. I think it's the most spoken language in the world. If not Mandarin, it's top two, right? So I thought it would have a lot of value. So maybe it'll be well received then if people are used to that kind of reality check scenario. But I think, in America where, you can bring things back and you can revisit vintage things. You have the opportunity to do anything here. Yeah. So, maybe we've all become too sensitive and it's okay to lift the lid of the box a little bit and see what's inside.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that The Boy Who Cried Wolf and the Ant and the Grasshopper are retold. What other stories are retold?
So I have The Tortoise and the Hare. We have The Farm Girl and Her Milk, which the lesson is don't count your chickens before they hatch. The Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, which there's a traitor amongst them that looks like them. That's another one that's a little bit dark. There's The Crab and His Mother. And there's 13 stories. So it's some of them are immediately recognizable, like The Tortoise and the Hare and The Golden Goose, right? Mm-hmm. The Goose with the Golden Eggs. And then a few of them are less known. And so that I wanted to put some in there that are like, oh, what's this? I don't remember this one.
Right. Yeah. Now, we all know that writing a book takes time, that publishing a book takes time, marketing a book takes time. Here you are, a physician, and I'm sure you have a lot on your plate. Where did the idea come? all right, I'm really busy now. Let me be even busier.
Right. That's exactly what happened. So I have three children. They're all teenagers. One is autistic. So that's a whole world by itself. Mm-hmm. Special needs is a whole thing by itself. And my job is awesome. My main job, which is pathology. I do dermatopathology, which is skin, specifically skin diseases. We look under the microscope and we diagnose, if it's cancer or not, melanoma, things like that. And I love it. I love pathology. I love dermpath. And it's beautiful. It's difficult. It's challenging. It's rewarding. It is definitely where I was supposed to go. Mm-hmm. But in the back of my mind, I always wanted to write this book, this specific book. Mm-hmm. I don't even have a second book idea. I don't, you know what I mean? This was the dream, was retelling Aesop's Fables. And so I took the challenge, but you're right. I didn't know how much work it was going to be. So I divide writing a book into three phases.
Okay.
The first phase is finishing the entire book cover to cover. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I guess so many people have ideas for books, but a lot of people don't finish that first step, right? They have a manuscript. They have some scribbles. They have a few notes in a journal, but cover to cover. You finish the book. You write your idea, okay? And if it's a picture book, you need an illustrator too, right? So your pictures and text, done. The second phase is the finding the agent, the publisher, and getting someone to commit to you. And this part is brutal because most of the time you're going to get rejected by most agents and publishers. That's normal. And it really beats you up because you start thinking 100 rejections later, maybe this isn't a good book. Mm-hmm. You start feeling like, oh God, nobody likes my book. Only my mom likes my book. So, there's a whole phase, and that can go on for years. So the writing can go on for years, and then looking for the agent and publisher and finding that publisher can go on for years. And then once you find that publisher, that needle in the haystack, you have to finish the editing, layout, print the book, which is usually printed overseas. Ours was printed in China. And then you have to do the hardest part of all, which is marketing the book, introducing the book to the world, finding a bookstore that will let you have your book there, doing events, reading at schools, doing a podcast like with you. It's an honor and a privilege for anyone to give you the time of day, because there are, I don't even know how many books are out there. There's 44 million books on Amazon. So it's hard to get anywhere. Mm-hmm. But yes, I wanted, I'm a hard worker. So once I have my sights set on something, I follow it through to the end. And I'm in the third phase now, which is sharing my book with the world and at book fairs, bookstores, this conversation, you know, and I'm in that third phase now. Awesome. It's gone really well. But it has been hard. You're right. It's taxing. It's time consuming.
Yep. Yep. It is. And, you know, one of the things that people are very surprised to find out is that there are literally thousands of books published every single month.
Yeah.
You know, and so
it's an avalanche.
It really is. And it does take a lot of work. But you understand that and you're doing the work, and that's fantastic. I'm curious, you said early on that your sons helped you write this book.
Yes.
How do they feel being published authors right now?
You know, they're teens. So they were excited when they were helping me, and they were excited very much during the making of the book. We argued, we fought over the language and the pictures. It was very animated and passionate. They were all in. And they really helped me a lot. My first draft, they hated it. They were like, who wrote this? Good Lord. We need to fix this. And so the three of us, they were 16 and 12 at the time. Now almost 14 and 18, right? When I got them involved. And they really contributed a lot to the book. The font, the colors, the pictures. I mean, I'm telling you, there were literal arguments breaking out over the details of the book. And then as the publication happened and printing, and now in this phase, they're less involved. They have come with me to a few events, but I don't force them to go to everything because they're teens. They're playing soccer, and one just went to college. So, you know, they're still there in the background. But they were very critical in helping make the book. And I don't think they realize how special it is to be a published author, because they're in their teen life, you know. I think maybe they'll realize it later when they're adults. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to leave this legacy for them, that we did this together. We did it. It got somewhere. It made it to Barnes & Noble. It made it to the, you know, local bookstore, Books and Books. We got nice reviews. I wanted to leave that for them.
That's wonderful. I love that. Well, we should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about your book and find out more about you.
Well, me, I guess you could Google, you know, but then we have a website. We have a book Instagram page.
Uh-huh.
And the book is on Amazon and at barnesandnoble.com and booksandbooks.com. So I can provide all of that.
Let's tell everybody the website.
Sure. It's www.boywhocriedwolfbook.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right. And the Instagram is boy.who.cried.wolf. That's the Instagram handle. And the Barnes & Noble link, I think if you put in the boy who cried wolf on Barnes & Noble search and you put in my name, Uzma Farooq, it will come up right away.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Or my son's names, Samir Ahmad and Amani Ahmad.
We've had a great time speaking to one of the co-authors of The Boy Who Cried Wolf and Other Great Stories with Lessons. Our guest has been Dr. Uzma Farooq. Hey, Dr. Uzma, thanks for being on Reading with Your Kids.
Thank you so much, Jed. This was awesome.
Hey, we'd love for you to check out two shows that are part of our Reading With Your Kids network. Guardian of the Games, a fantastic Dungeons and Dragons-based podcast that is very family-friendly and a whole lot of fun. Also, we want you to check out Connecticut Book Festivals. You find both of those on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple, Spotify, wherever you find Reading With Your Kids. You can find Guardian of the Games and Connecticut Book Festivals. Our guest is here today to celebrate a brand new picture book. It's called Mine. Please welcome back to Reading With Your Kids, Heather Fontaine Youngs. Heather, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you, Jed, for having me back again.
Glad to have you back on Mine. What an interesting title.
Yeah, so thank you. Should I tell you where it all came from?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, my stepbrother and I met him when I was about 6 years old. And as soon as we met, he's like a year younger than me. We clicked automatically. We clicked. We both love to create. My father is a musician. His mother was, she creates dolls and everything. So we were always encouraged to create. So we would always get together and I would draw the pictures and he would come up with the story or vice versa. So a few years ago, we reunited. He came back to New York and we came back to, brainstorm some more, and he asked me to help him illustrate a children's book that he was making. And then we just started brainstorming, and he said, we should make a book about a little kid who just doesn't want to share. And, you know, I'm like, yeah. And he said, like, Mine. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like that would be fun, because as an educator, pre-K teacher, I know all about this topic. So that is where it all came from, and then I was to be the artist for it. And then I just kind of took over the whole idea, and that's where Mine came from.
Wonderful. That is an issue for so many kids. Well, it's an issue for a lot of adults too, but it's definitely an issue and something that young kids have a hard time learning sometimes, the whole idea of sharing.
It is, and sometimes it's hard because sometimes you don't want to share. Sometimes it's okay if you don't want to share at that moment, and that's why I wanted to incorporate tips for sharing, and one of them is sometimes it may not be the time to share, and it's hard, but you may have a child or a student that doesn't know the concept at all. So those are why the other tips are important to help them, you know, understand that touchy subject sometimes of sharing.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about some of those tips, please. And again, you mentioned you have a long history of dealing and teaching young kids in preschool and early childhood.
Yes, I would say my oldest son is 22, so I'm just going to give myself 23 years of experience as far as an educator, and most of that was in pre-K in New York City public school, that I was there for 17 years straight. So I have a lot of experience with this age group and this topic and trying to help children take turns and share, and it's really about social and emotional as well. You know, how you feel, how you might feel if that happened to you, or maybe you don't want to. These are just topics that sometimes it's hard for parents to talk about, and some educators too, because a child wants what they want sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
And one of the things I think you said, I think I heard you say, sometimes it's okay to let a kid know that, hey, I don't want to share this moment.
Yeah.
Right now. I kind of want to be alone. And how can we know when, as parents, as caregivers, when it's best to kind of give our kids that space? And then maybe there are other times when, hey, we should probably push them a little bit to be more social.
You know, listen, that can be hard to figure out sometimes, when you want to allow them to, you know, be by themselves and maybe not share with somebody. And sometimes you want to encourage them. I know that for me, if I had a student or even my own child and they just got something, they just held in their hand, somebody came and said, can I have it? That would be a time where I would say, well, they just, you know, got this. So we're going to wait. You may use things like timers. If you had more than one child that really wants to use something, you know, I would introduce a timer. Something like that that can help motivate them. But then sometimes, say the timer's up and they still don't want to share. And maybe it's not an object that's just their personal object. Maybe it is a classroom object. Then we have to talk about, it is time to share now. You know, we want to give you time, but, you know, look at your classmate or your friend. They would like to use it now, and you can always get it back. So there's a lot of talking, a lot of patience, but also putting yourself in their shoes, if you remember being a child. But letting them know that you have those feelings too sometimes. Sometimes I don't always want to share, or, you know, like, I would always bring in my own personal self examples. My own children, even if I'm driving my car, I would tell my students, if I'm driving my car and somebody wants to get over on the lane, you know, I would have to try to do whatever I could to try to make a connection for them to see why sharing can be important. And sometimes a person needs to wait. Mm-hmm. So,
I know myself, it's hard for me to wait when I'm in the gym and I want to get on a machine and I see somebody there sitting there texting somebody on their phone while I could be using
machine. You're like, wow. And then you can talk about nice ways to ask, maybe. You don't want to be pushy, but then, you know, after a while, you're like, oh, are you done now? So we try to talk about how to politely ask for things. But then you have the child that doesn't want to share at all, and then we have to talk to them about, you know, how's this making the other person feel? This isn't just your property. You know? So these, even though this seems like, just sharing, no, it really can be a complex subject, especially for people who have young children, and this could be happening every day in their house.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want that.
One of the things I saw in the notes is that there are very few words in this book, lots of pictures. So I'm thinking that there's lots of opportunities for conversations as we're experiencing this book with our kids.
Yes, I as I said, I'm an educator for so many years. I love picture books that didn't have too many words because it allowed the students to create or to use the illustrations to help them figure out what they think might be happening. And so that's what I did here. And I also included tips on how to ask open-ended questions to students or children about the book, because a book without many words can be hard to read because there's not many words there. And if you're not experienced in asking certain questions, open-ended questions to activate those conversations, you know, you may let something go by where you could have had an opportunity to increase vocabulary skills or conversation skills or talk about social and emotional things. So this is why I incorporated that as well in the book, in the back, tips on what types of questions can you ask to activate the child's vocabulary, their social, emotional, conversation, and creativity, because they can make up their own story if they want. They can add more to the story. They can add dialogue to the story. Mm-hmm. That's why I thought it would be fun, especially if it's geared towards maybe 3, 4, 5, maybe 6-year-olds. I mean, some 6-year-olds may still not know how to share. It would be best that it has more, I guess, opportunity for them to kind of create a story, put themselves in the story.
Yeah.
How would you feel? How do you think this boy feels? You know, so that's why it's very little words, just enough to kind of give a background, so have some guidance.
Mm-hmm.
It's about.
As an early educator, are you able to kind of spot kids when you have a classroom of kids? Are you able to sit back and say, yeah, that kid's parents reads to him or her every night, and that kid, I don't think anybody's reading to that kid.
You can tell the difference. You can, because they may know how to hold the book, or they may have more attention span for a story.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you're 4 years old, you know, your attention span is still, you're still working on that. So reading at home is helpful. You can tell the difference.
Yeah.
They know the front cover, the back cover, and they just have a little more attention span. To listen to a longer book as time goes on. I like to increase the length of books that I read to my students. So reading to them at home allows them to have that listening skill and the stamina to listen to a longer story.
Yeah. Yeah. We've celebrated the fact that the statistic that kids who are read to every night, 15, 20 minutes a night, by the time they get to kindergarten, first grade, they will have heard 800,000 more words than their peers who hadn't been read to. And a lot of that isn't necessarily that they've heard words that have been read out of a book. It's the conversations that we have when we're talking with kids.
Yes. That's the really the I'm going to say the point of reading the book, but mm-hmm. yes, talking about it, the comprehension of what are we reading, and also just the conversation about how it makes you feel, what the story's about, and connecting with their parent is just adds to all of that desire to want to hear stories and learn more.
Yeah.
I do. My son is 12, and I do every so often read to him at night. Of course, he can read by himself, but he enjoys and I enjoy it, and I know that that has helped him. I just know that it's helped him throughout his time in school.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely encourage families to continue to read to their tweens and their teens because it's a great way to start those conversations. If you want to have a conversation with your kid, it's a lot better to do it with a book than to sit down and say, young one, we need to have a conversation.
Oh, yes. So I know. I'm learning that. I'm like, how can I sneak these conversations in? But the character in the book is around his age. So mm-hmm. I can somehow, you know, throw some other things in here.
Yeah. You kind of got to be a little sneaky sometimes with parenting.
Mm-hmm. And as being an educator as well. That's why I said this could be a good opportunity to give those tips to parents so that they can help their children with this topic and with social emotional and with vocabulary. Everything can just be wrapped up into one book.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
Tommy, you know, you shared with us that you taught for a couple of decades, and now you're still teaching through your books. Do you ever take the time to sit down and think about the families that are cuddled up together on the couch or in bed reading your stories?
I do, but I think I need to imagine it more. And I don't know. That makes me excited. So now I'm going to imagine that more.
Excellent.
You know,
I'm glad I planted the seed.
Yes, because sometimes when I create, it's really just because I just love to create. Of course, I want everybody to enjoy it. But my first thing is I created this. And then I have to think beyond that other people are reading it and curled up with it. And I'm like, oh, yes, that's important, too.
We had a great time speaking to the author of Mine. It's the new picture book from our guest, Heather Fontaine Youngs. Heather, thanks so much for being back on Reading with Your Kids.
Thank you, Jed. Thank you for having me. I appreciate this very much.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Reading with Your Kids. Well, join us for the next exciting episode of the show. If this episode made you smile or gave you something to think about, please consider sharing a link to the show with someone you love. We can be connected with on our social media networks, facebook.com/readingwithyourkids, @readingwithyourkids on Instagram, @JedleyMagic on X. Our YouTube channel, youtube.com/readingwithyourkids, readingwithyourkids.com is our website. Want to thank the folks who made today's show so wonderful, starting with our guest, John Eric Lopano. Please be sure to check out The Language of Birds. Dr. Usma Farouk. Please be sure to check out The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And Heather Fontaine Youngs. Please be sure to check out Mine. I want to thank my team, Fatima Khan, Chris Doherty. I want to thank my beautiful wife for all the support she gives me. Most of all, we want to thank you. You are amazing. And you are making the world a kinder, more empathetic, better place. And you're doing that every time you read with your kids. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading with Your Kids.